This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Lester Brown, president of Earth Policy Institute. Lester was founder and president of the World Watch Institute during its first 26 years and has authored and co-authored many books, including Plan B 4.0 and World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. He has been honored with numerous prizes, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the United Nations Environment Prize, Japan's Blue Planet Prize, and 25 honorary degrees. Lester Brown is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity, published in 2012. Welcome.
Diane, it's my pleasure to be here again.
What led you to write Full Planet, Empty Plates? What is your purpose?
Well, it has seemed to me for some time that there's a tendency to think of the current food situation with high prices and tight supplies worldwide as temporary. I think most people link it to the drought in this country this past summer and the intense heat, and that clearly played a role. But this is not a temporary situation we're in. There are a series of trends now converging on both the demand side of the equation and the supply side of the food equation to make it increasingly difficult for the world's farmers to keep up with the growth in demand. And that's basically why I wrote the book. On the demand side, we have population growth. That's not new, 80 million a year. It means there'll be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night, and tomorrow night there'll be another 219,000. So there's a relentless growth of population. That's one factor. The second thing is that there are now more people moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products than at any time in history. We estimate this total at something like 3 billion people, and a big chunk of that, of course, is China. And then the third thing, of course, in addition to population growth and moving up the food chain, is we're now using grain not just to feed livestock and poultry, but to fuel cars as well. And in this country, in the last couple of years, we have used more grain to fuel cars than we have fed to livestock and poultry. On the supply side, we have some serious problems, relatively new ones. One is shrinking water supplies. Half of us live in countries today that are overpumping their aquifers, their underground water supplies. Overpumping is something you can do in the short run, but not in the long run. By definition, it's a short-term phenomenon. We look at the big three grain producers, for example, China, India, and the United States, and we see extensive overpumping in all three. The World Bank estimates that in India, 175 million people are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. My own estimate for China is that 120 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. And here in the United States, we know that we're in trouble on the waterfront throughout the southwestern United States in particular, shrinking irrigated area in leading agricultural states such as Texas and California, for example. And this shrinkage in these states is the result of both overpumping and aquifer depletion, but also because of diverting more and more irrigation water to cities. So we're looking at a serious water challenge on the production side. We're also looking at climate change. Agriculture as it exists today has evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. Agriculture as it exists today is designed to maximize production with that climate system, but that climate system is no more. It's now constantly changing. So each year, the climate system is more and more out of sync with the agricultural system, making it difficult for farmers to expand production fast enough. And then the third thing is, and this is not widely known yet, but in the more agriculturally advanced countries, grain yields have plateaued. For example, rice yield per acre in Japan has not increased at all in the last 15 years. It increased for decades before that, but now it's plateaued. The same is true for South Korea, and China's rice production might start plateauing any year now. Then we have the three leading grain producers in Europe, France, Germany, and the UK, where wheat yields have plateaued. So we're beginning to hit this sort of glass ceiling in the more agriculturally advanced countries where we can't raise yields any further. So we have a number of challenges now between water and climate and the glass ceiling on yields to make it difficult for farmers to keep up.
Would you elaborate on the evidence that we're entering a time of food scarcity?
Well, the evidence we can see in food prices, world grain prices have doubled over the last decade. Soybean prices have doubled over the last decade. And for you and me, as Americans, we spend only 10% or so of our income on food. So if the price of wheat doubles, it really doesn't affect us very much because the cost of the wheat in a loaf of bread is really very small. It's the transportation, the milling, the flour, the baking, the packaging, the delivery is where the expenditures come. But for people living in developing countries who are already spending 50 to 70% of their income on food, when the price of grain doubles, they're hit rather directly. For example, if you live in New Delhi and you go to the market and buy wheat, bring it home and grind it into a meal to make chapatis, if the price of wheat doubles, the price of your chapatis double because it is the cost of the wheat that really determines the price of chapatis. So this is leading to a lot of belt tightening in low-income countries, countries shifting to one meal a day, for example. And now in several countries, we have a new phenomenon, something we have not seen before, and that is we're seeing families begin to plan foodless days. We're seeing this in Nigeria, in Ethiopia, in India. At the beginning of the week, the family will decide how many days that week they can eat. 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. And in many cases now, families can't afford enough wheat or rice or cornmeal or whatever to eat every day. I mean, this is an amazing development. I don't think most of the world is even aware that this is happening, but it is happening, and there is a survey by Save the Children, a fairly recent survey, that shows, as I recall, something like 24% of the families in Nigeria now plan foodless days. I think in Ethiopia it's 22%, in India something like 14%. So we're moving into new territory in the world food economy, and most of us, because we live in countries where we don't spend much of our income on food, aren't really aware of what's happening and what a potentially serious problem it is.
Would you also comment on the issue of grain reserves?
Well, the key indicator of food security is how much grain you have in the bin when the new harvest begins. I mean, the goal in agriculture always is to make it to the new harvest, but you have to have some grain in the bin. You can't draw everything down to zero because a lot of the stocks are between in the storage and transport between the producer and the consumer. For example, wheat grown in Kansas in the United States leaves the wheat farms and goes to the local grain silos, and it is stored there. And then it's transported by rail to Houston or New Orleans to a port, and then it goes by ship to, let's say, Egypt, and then it's in grain elevators at the port there, and then it goes to the flour millers and eventually reaches the people. But there's a long supply line there, and it takes quite a bit of grain just to keep that supply line filled, because if it ever empties, then whoever's on the other end is going to be in trouble. The other thing that's happening is we're beginning to see more and more food unrest as prices go up, and as prices go up far faster than incomes, and people have trouble keeping up. This was clearly one of the factors, not the only factors, but probably one of the top three things that led to the Arab Spring of a year or so ago.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lester Brown, president of Earth Policy Institute and author of the book Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's look in more detail at the issue of moving up the food chain affecting food scarcity. Would you say more about that and talk about the inefficiencies in how we currently develop protein for humans?
Probably the best way to understand this is to look at grain consumption in a low-income country like India, where it's about 400 pounds of grain per person per year, roughly a pound a day. When you only have a pound of grain per day, you consume almost all of that directly. You can't afford to convert it into animal protein. In this country, we consume about 1,600 pounds of grain per person per year. And that means that we consume most of it indirectly in the form of meat and milk and eggs and all the things we make from dairy products like yogurt and cheese and ice cream and so forth. So we live pretty high on the food chain in this country. People in India live very low. So we consume basically four times as much grain per person as the average person in India does. When we convert grain into animal protein, of course, we end up with less animal protein than we do grain in the conversion process, but converting into some things is more efficient than others. For example, it takes 2 pounds of grain or so to add 1 pound of live weight for chickens, for example. For pigs, it's closer to 4 pounds of grain per additional pound of live weight. And if you look at cattle, steers in a feedlot, then it takes about 7 pounds of grain to add a pound of live weight. So this means that poultry is the cheapest source of meat we have. Pork is intermediate, and beef is the most costly, assuming it's produced in feedlots. And that's where most future growth in beef production will have to come, because all the world's grasslands are now being fully grazed. In fact, much of the world's grassland is being overgrazed. So the most efficient, the most grain-efficient source of animal protein is chicken, and the least efficient is beef.
On the supply side, you mentioned climate change as being a key issue. Would you say more about how the rising global temperatures actually affect the ability to grow crops?
The rule of thumb that's used for measuring the effect of higher temperature on grain yields is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. That's the rule of thumb that's been used for decades now, but it turns out that it's probably quite a bit higher than that. That is, a 1 degree rise in Celsius may reduce yields by closer to 16% than 10%. So grains, indeed, all crops are sensitive to temperature, and they have evolved to maximize production with the temperatures that have been remarkably stable for the last 11,000 years. Now, suddenly, that's changing. What we see with corn, for example, and corn is very vulnerable to high temperatures during the pollination season. The corn plant has a very complex sex life, with the tassel at the top of the corn stalk producing pollen, the sperm, if you will, and these pollen drift downward. And in order for an ear of corn to develop, in order for a kernel of grain to develop, one of those pollen must fall on the strand of silk coming out the end of the ear of corn. You know how when you're doing corn on the cob for consumption, what a nuisance it is to get rid of all those silk strands? But those silk strands are connected to each kernel site on the corn cob. And in order for a kernel to develop, a grain of pollen must fall on the silk and travel up that silk strand. It's sort of like a fallopian tube, and then fertilization occurs. Now, if you get intense hot weather during the pollination period, the silk at the end of the ear will dry out and turn brown, and it will not be able to transmit the pollen to the kernel sites. So high temperature by itself can disrupt the pollination of corn. Beyond that, plants, as temperature rises from a very low level, say from freezing, as temperature rises, plant growth increases until you reach 68 degrees. And then it stabilizes, and temperature can go up to 95 degrees, and it won't have much effect on the growth of the plant. But beyond 95 degrees, yields begin to decline. At 104 degrees, photosynthesis comes to a halt entirely. So the plant becomes basically dormant, and there's no activity at all at 104 degrees. So that's kind of how rising temperature affects grain yields.
If you look at all of the factors that affect the ability to produce crops, how would you weight the different ones in terms of how essential they are?
Probably the most basic is water, and closely related are nutrients. And the things that we've learned to do is that we know what nutrients plants use, for example, so we can test the soil before we plant them and see exactly which ones they need, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, boron, copper, whatever, and then we can include these nutrients in fertilizer, and that fertilizer then will make sure that the plant gets all the nutrients it needs. With water, what we have done is, with rice, of course, rice everywhere is grown in water, so water is not a constraint there, but we know that we grow a lot of the world's wheat and a lot of the world's corn on unirrigated land. If we have irrigation, then we can assure that we'll sort of get a maximum yield. But without irrigation, then crop yields are affected directly by rainfall. And if there is a drought, of course, it'll reduce grain yields. And that's exactly what we've seen throughout much of the United States this year, but particularly in the Corn Belt. We're seeing yields drop precipitously, both because of water shortages of drought and because of record high temperatures.
Looking also on the demand side, the population, consumers moving up the food chain and ethanol for cars, how would you weight those in terms of their importance in affecting our food supply?
Well, population growth has been fairly steady for the last few decades at about 80 million a year, and that translates into 219,000 people, additional people every day. So that's been with us for some time, and that hasn't changed very much, but it's always there. It's relentless, good weather, bad weather, whatever. We've got 80 million more people to feed each year. Rising affluence traditionally has been a secondary factor after population growth, but it now looks as though there are so many people moving up the food chain at the same time, and as I noted, importantly in China, that this may now be the leading source of growth in the demand for food. That is, producing basically more corn, which is the world's feed grain, and trying to keep up, trying to expand corn production fast enough to keep up with the rise in affluence. And then the third factor, and it now accounts for about a third of the U.S. grain harvest, is the use of grain to produce fuel for cars. I think last year we harvested about 400 million tons of grain in this country, and of that, 129 million tons went to ethanol distilleries to produce fuel for cars. That grain, that 129 million tons, is enough to feed roughly 400 million people at average world consumption levels for 1 year. So it's not inconsequential. Indeed, the grain required to fill a 25-gallon SUV tank with ethanol is enough to feed one person for a year. So it's easy to consume a substantial share of the world's food supply to fuel cars if we're not careful.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lester Brown, president of Earth Policy Institute and author of the book Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food. What kind of response are governments mounting so far to the challenge of food scarcity?
Well, they're not doing very much. We see meetings of the G20, for example, or the G8, and they always come out with some sort of a statement about we need to accelerate our efforts to expand food production, to eradicate hunger and malnutrition and so forth, but they're never very specific. And the reality is it's becoming very difficult now to expand production enough to keep up with demand. And that's why we're seeing record high prices for corn, soybeans, wheat, and food generally. The World Bank World Food Index is now double what it was a decade ago, and it's going to keep climbing in the future. This is not a temporary situation, and this is what I think the world is not prepared for. I don't think most political leaders have yet quite realized this. I think they like to think this is a temporary situation that will, you know, will pass and then things will go back to normal. But there's no norm to go back to now. With climate change, there is no norm. We're in a state of constant flux, for example. So this is what's new, and this is what's making the feeding a population expanding by 80 million a year such a challenging thing now.
Would you comment on land acquisitions or land grabs as a response to food scarcity?
Well, back in 2007, late 2007, early 2008, world grain prices jumped dramatically, roughly doubling in a matter of months. And so the importing countries began looking around to see how much grain they could import and if they could build up their stocks and so forth. And they suddenly realized there just wasn't much grain out there, and they sort of panicked. And the first response to that was for governments in importing countries, in grain importing countries, to buy land in other countries to produce food for themselves. And once this started, it just sort of caught on like an epidemic of disease, because everyone realized they needed to make sure they were controlling enough land and the water resources that go with the land to feed their people. So we had this land rush. I think I say in the book, food has become the new oil. Land is the new gold. If you look at investments in land acquisitions for the last, say roughly a decade now, the increase in land values has been roughly double that of the Dow Jones Industrial Index. So if you want to get a good rate of return, the thing to invest in now is land, because it's fast becoming a scarce commodity.
Which countries are buying land?
Well, a surprising number of countries, and now agribusiness firms, even investment banks, some university endowments, for example, are beginning to invest in land funds. These are newly created funds, so you can just invest in land by itself. So it's a broad-based source of investors now. Almost every agribusiness company in the world of any size is now trying to acquire land to produce the commodities it deals with, whether it's oil seeds like soybeans or feed grains like corn or food grains like wheat and rice. It's kind of the final stage in the new geopolitics of food, is to try to gain control of enough land and water to produce for your country, or if you're an agribusiness company, to acquire enough land to be able to profit from rising land and food prices in the future.
Which countries are selling the land?
Well, a lot of the countries that are selling the land are in Africa. And the land is being bought at a very low price, and it is actually land that's being farmed by villagers. And the governments are selling the land, and one senses that there's a lot of under-the-table money involved here for political leaders in African countries. And so they just sell the land, and then the investing country or company sends in its farm equipment, including bulldozers, and they just literally eliminate villages in countries like Ethiopia, for example, or the Sudan, or countries in West Africa. It's a heartless sort of thing. And when you think about it, what it represents, it's part of a global redistribution of wealth from the poorest people in the world. Those who live in rural villages in Africa and elsewhere, losing the bit of wealth they have in the form of land assets, becoming even poorer, while the wealthy, the upper 1% or whatever that upper range is, are becoming more affluent. From a social point of view, it's a very sad situation that's unfolding, and it's happening everywhere. There's very little organized opposition to this outside a small group of NGOs.
What are the key steps we need to take to alleviate food scarcity?
One is we need to get the brakes on population growth sooner rather than later. And the key to that is getting family planning services to all the women in the world who want to plan their families but cannot do so because they don't have access to family planning services. Filling that family planning gap would cost so little that it would get lost in the rounding of the U.S. defense budget. But it is so important to the future of people, not only in the low-income countries, but worldwide. So that's one thing, fill the family planning gap. A second is we need to launch an effort to raise water productivity comparable to the one we launched a half century ago, beginning in the 1950s, to raise land productivity. These are two of the big things we need to do. And the third, of course, the other big thing, is to get the brakes on climate change. And that means restructuring the world energy economy and doing it quickly. That is shifting from fossil fuels, from coal and oil and natural gas, to wind and solar and geothermal energy. And the exciting thing is that we have an abundance of wind energy in the world, and of solar energy, and of geothermal energy. We just need to provide the incentives to build these industries and begin tapping these new sources of energy.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Pick an issue that's important to you and get involved. Maybe it's closing coal-fired power plants, that is, cutting carbon emissions. This is a very successful program being led by the Sierra Club. They're in the process of closing these. So that would be one thing. Another is, if you're concerned about, say, the population issue, join one of the population groups. Become involved and support the International Family Planning Programs. So these are some of the things that one can do from home and that can make a difference.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lester.
Diane, my pleasure.
You have just been listening to Lester Brown, president of Earth Policy Institute and author of the book Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity, published in 2012 by W.W. Norton. For more information, check on the web at earthpolicy.org. Again, that's earthpolicy.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.